Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Bill Russell is an NBA legend. Between 1956 and 1969, he led the Boston Celtics to 11 NBA championships. He did it like this.
Russell steals the ball. On the right, it goes to Casey. Back to Noel. He stops. He pops. It's good. 103-71. 32 points. It's just hard to believe.
He stops, he pops, it's good. Now Bill Russell is 75, still going strong, and writing about his life in basketball and his longtime friendship with his legendary coach, Red Auerbach. We've got an all-star team with us today. From Newton, Massachusetts, Dan Shaughnessy joins us, celebrated sports columnist for the Boston Globe. He's written two books about the Celtics, Seeing Red and Evergreen. His latest book is Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Baseball. Dan Shaughnessy, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, number one on our roster and lifelong Celtics fan, On Point News analyst, Jack Beattie.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dan.
And drum roll, please, with us from Seattle, Washington, the one and only Bill Russell. He played his entire career with the Boston Celtics, and it was a career like no other. His new book with Alan Steinberg is Red and Me, my coach, my lifelong friend, Bill Russell. It is a pleasure to have you here.
How are you doing today?
We're doing just great, and so delighted to have you with us. We're going to dive into this whole relationship, and it's a wonderful telling that you give of it in Red and Me. But I want to get very contemporary first, if you'd be good enough, Bill. I know you've been watching the finals and playoffs. Got Magic and Cavs and Lakers and Nuggets out there. What do you see? Who are you putting your bet on, Bill?
Well, when both teams show up, it's exciting games. Sometimes one team or another doesn't show up ready to play, and the results are disastrous for them. I never, ever predict what's going to happen, even when I was playing. But I'm one of those, well, I'm a really old guy, so I can wait for them to play the games and enjoy watching them.
You'll wait and you'll watch them, Dan Shaughnessy. When you look at what's going on as we head toward the championship this year, you think about the kind of play we're seeing on the court and the kind of play we would have seen in the many, many appearances that Bill Russell made in NBA finals and championship games. How do you compare, Dan?
It's really hard to do. I mean, eras change. All I know is great players are great players, and there's never been anyone like Bill Russell since he walked away from it in 1969, having won 11 and 13 years. And you just don't see that kind of dominant defensive presence down low that Bill Russell brought to the game. The outlet passes, the running game, a lot of it has changed. And we're still looking 40 years later. There hasn't been another one come along.
Paint a picture. Remind us of just how great the stature Bill Russell was in those years, in his era, Dan, of what he meant to basketball, what he meant to the Boston Celtics.
It absolutely changed the face of basketball when Bill came on in December of 1956, I believe, right from the Olympics. And the Celtics had always been good. They had been in the playoffs. They couldn't get over the hump, and Red saw what he needed. He brings in this athletic young center who plays defense. They don't worry about how many points he scores. They run the floor. They beat people down the floor. They're brilliant. They do it with intellect as well as athleticism. And Bill Russell, he never lost a walk-away game. When there's a game where the winner goes on and the loser goes home, I think his record is 21-0. That would include the NCAA tournament, the Olympics, and every seventh or fifth deciding game that he ever played in.
Jack Beattie, you were there, and much more than once, you saw it again and again in those years when Bill Russell absolutely dominated.
I did, and it's a great honor to be on the same program with you, Mr. Russell.
Thank you.
And you know, to me, as a young fan, and this book confirms it, there was about Bill's playing something that was about character. In other words, yeah, he was greatly skilled. He was clearly very smart. He knew how to play the game. But there was a kind of moral emanation that he gave off, that it was in his dignity, it was in his bearing, it was in the way he played the game, and his and also in the way that he would battle under the boards. And, you know, he'd get clobbered and knocked down on the floor and get up, and with that characteristic lope, head down the floor again. And there was a kind of parable in there about life. And, you know, it took some of the negative off the feeling that the Celtics were inevitably going to win. They were going to win. We all knew that. But it wasn't like being a Yankees fan where it's like rooting for capitalism. It wasn't that at all. And I think that's because Bill was there putting everything into it, suffering, giving the game everything, and somehow winning on character.
Bill Russell, I wish you would tell the story, which you tell so beautifully in the book, Red and Me, of that 12th game in your rookie year. Pivotal moment in your entry into the NBA, your really integration into the Celtics, and in your really the beginning of your deep relationship with Red Auerbach. Can you take us there, Bill?
First, I want to tell Dan Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
The year after I retired,
One
of my lifelong friends, John Havlicek, called me, said, you know, I miss you more on offense than I do on defense.
I love it.
Both ways.
What happened was the Celtics had a way of playing, and they were a great offensive unit. But what had happened in the playoffs before, they were playing with a donut. That's what they call a hole in the middle. Mm-hmm. Nobody there.
And here it is, 1956. You're coming off the Olympics. You're on the team, but the donut's still going on.
Yeah, well, so Red always started the games. He'd ask everybody what they thought. And Kuhl said, well, I think I could take Slater Martin down on the blocks and wear him out. Well, we started that way, and we were getting clobbered because two things about that. First of all, it's bad basketball because your point guard is playing center. Who's going to play your point? So that means everybody's playing out of position. But that wasn't my thought at the time, was that if I play center and the guards are going down the post, where do I go? So Red had a thing then where the Celtics never sat down because we were in such great condition that in timeouts we didn't need to sit.
But you had a timeout. You huddled up. But you personally didn't join the huddle.
No, I went and sit down. And
you're a rookie. The coach calls you for a huddle, and you don't join it.
Right. So I go sit down, and everybody's looking at me, and Red's looking at me. He says, why aren't you in the huddle? I says, I play center. Everybody else is playing center. I don't need to be in the huddle to know to stay the hell out the way. And so
he could have sent you right to the locker room, right there, right then.
Yeah, well, if I had been one of my previous coaches, that's what would have happened. That would have probably ended my NBA career as a troublemaker, a malcontent, whatever you want to call it. But Red just said, okay, nobody else play center. Now,
you said it. He agreed. He just took it and said, all right, you're right.
And when we got home from the trip, he put in a play. We only had five plays up until that time. He put in a play, the sixth play, and that was for me to shoot. And we sat in the, fool around the gym for a couple of hours. He was asking me to put input. What did I like? Well, I would like cutters. I don't like to just feed the ball and everybody stand around. And because if you're standing around, your transition from offense to defense does not exist. There's no offensive rebounding, and there's no motion. And so, and there's no balance. And so we worked that out and put that play in. And what happened, he found out that I was a real good passer.
And you found out that you had a coach who would listen to you, even when, you know, who wouldn't put his ego first, he would actually listen to a rookie who wouldn't join the huddle.
Well, Red's idea was to win with what he has. And in order to do that, he has to get the best out of all the players. So what he does is he watches them, finds out what they do, and has a place in the system for that particular player. And so so what he did, as he found out different things that I could do, he made that part of the system.
And that was the beginning of, as you write in Red and Me, a beautiful relationship. Dan Shaughnessy, how many coaches in the NBA today can you imagine taking that, you know, giving that response to a rookie who refused to join the huddle and, you know, was coaching?
The whole thing has always been really interesting to me, this whole dynamic. And I got to know Red a little bit. I wrote a book with him years later.
Right.
And just, I grew up with the Celtics. I was a fan here. I was in high school before I realized they don't win the championship every year. I mean, it was. I didn't know there was any other way. And all of a sudden, I'm a freshman. It's like, oh, they didn't win this year. It's 67. What happened?
Right.
But it was, we were taught certain things as high school players that we picked up from the Celtics. The idea that you didn't have to have a scoring champion on the team. You know, you spread it around. It's a sort of team play. Doesn't matter who gets the credit. All the good things that were taught there. But one thing that's always intrigued me, and I'm right in the middle of Bill's new book, which I've loved all of Bill's book. I was a big fan of Second Wind. And this one here is terrific. But again, we get to the idea Bill doesn't have to practice with the other guys. And that's so counter to what every high school coach should. Same rules.
No kidding.
Same rules for the same guys.
Hold that thought. We'll ask him all about it. Dan Shaughnessy, Jack Beatty, Bill Russell with us. His new book is Red and Me. What made Bill Russell great, and how much did Red Auerbach matter in that greatness? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Greer's putting the ball on a play. He gets it out deep, and Havlicek steals it over the stand goal. Havlicek stole the ball. It's all over. It's all over.
Johnny Most, and an iconic moment from the Havlicek-Bill Russell era in the NBA. We're talking today with all-time NBA basketball great Bill Russell about his life in the game and his great friend and coach, Red Auerbach. Bill Russell joins us today from Seattle, Washington. His new book is Red and Me, My Coach, My Lifelong Friend. We're also delighted to be joined today by celebrated sports columnist for the Boston Globe, Dan Shaughnessy. He wrote Seeing Red, the Red Auerbach story. He knows this history. His latest book is Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Basketball. Jack Beatty's here. You can join the conversation. Do you remember when Bill Russell just dominated the game of basketball year after year after year? What's your favorite memory, favorite image of Russell and Auerbach? What made Bill Russell great, and how much did Red Auerbach matter in that greatness? Bill Russell, I was struck by the same thing as Dan. What do you mean? You're the greatest team player in history, and you didn't have to practice with the rest of the team? What's that about?
Well, Red always, first thought always was, does it make sense? He was one, besides being a mathematical genius, he had common sense. And so as I tell the story, in the, we're in practice one day, and he told me I didn't look up to par. I'll clean it up for radio.
okay, yeah. Thank you.
And he says, what's the matter with you? I said, I'm tired. Well, at the time, Red and I were working on a formula how he could keep me physically and mentally ready to play as many games as possible. And we had worked out a program where I played 46 minutes a game. And for my first 5 years, I averaged 46 minutes a game. And he said, you're tired? I said, yeah. He says, well, don't scrimmage today. I would practice the plays and other things, but when they started to scrimmage, I would go sit down. Because he says, it doesn't make sense to play this guy 46 minutes a game and then wear him out practicing. And it was just a matter of, one of the things about Red, he never made any rules or did things impractical to show who's boss.
Hey, Bill, don't forget, I'm sorry to interrupt, but not only did Bill Russell go sit down, he sat down with a cup of tea. Let's
yes. Not forget that. Cup of tea. Take that. Take that.
Dan, listen to this story. So I'm not practicing, okay?
Yeah.
So one day Red comes to practice and he says, "You're going to give me 20 minutes of hard practice today." He's pointing his finger in my face. So we start practicing and I'm goofing off. I mean, really goofing off. So after about 5 or 10 minutes, he kicks us all out of the gym. "Get out of here. I don't get just get out of here." Next day, he comes up to me and he's got about 8 or 10 cigars. He says, "Listen, I got these cigars. I got nothing to do and no place to go. You're going to give me 20 minutes of hard practice if it takes till tomorrow."
I'm prepared. I'm stocked up.
Okay, so. Yeah. We start to practice, and I practice like it's the seventh game of the playoffs. Well, nice guys, but my teammates couldn't compete. The first unit, we're beating them like 48-3. And Red calls timeout, and he says, "You're a no-good SOB. You've run 2 practices in a row. You didn't have to practice that hard."
Let's get a little bit of the voice of the master coach. Here he is, Bill, Red Auerbach, 2004 interview with NPR, talking about what it takes to be a great coach.
"A good coach will tell you what to do and everything like that, but a great coach will tell you what to do in such a way that you will absorb it and you will react. See, it's not what you say, it's what they hear.
It's what they hear, maybe what Bill Russell heard. Jack Beattie, there's Bill Russell drinking tea, on the sidelines while practice goes on. And yet, Jack, in the moment, in the game, the celebrated greatest team player of all time."
Yes, that's the remarkable paradox there, isn't it? I think Red, what comes clear there to me, at least, that Red Auerbach was really a great strategist and psychologist. And he understood that there might have been a downside in terms of the team's morale, at least momentarily, to the idea that we're busting our humps here and he's up in the stand. But once people thought about it and how much they owed to his play, they realized that Red was making a strategic decision. He's too valuable to be worn out in these scrimmages. And you, the players, with an objective appreciation of the task, recognize that. So I think that's really to describe a great coach. I think the Vince Lombardi image of a coach, the coach as the sort of dictator and all-powerful, that just doesn't work motivating grown men. And if anything comes through in this book, it's that when Bill Russell arrived at the Celtics in 1950s, he was a grown man and wanted to be treated that way.
Can I get to a question speaking of that? That's
yes,
a really
Dan
good point.
Shaughnessy.
Bill's written this wonderful book about his lifelong relationship with his coach, his professional coach. Mm-hmm. Now, in my reading of this book, Bill Russell, Bill, you won 56 straight college games, 2 NCAA championships, and an Olympic gold medal. And if I'm not mistaken, you write about those coaches and you do not mention their names.
Wow.
That's right. Was there anything intentional about that?
Yes. Also,
yeah. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. It's all Red and only Red, but you had done a little bit before Red.
Right. I was the basis of the book is, to me, was about friendship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the things I told about the experience, I did not want to have a list of my grievances.
Right.
I just wanted to say some of the experiences that I had that prepared me to meet Red. Okay? You see, if Red had been like those other guys, we would have been as successful.
Right.
Not as successful, I don't think. Because going back to college, if you got a minute.
Yes. For
my
you?
My very sure. first varsity game against Cal Berkeley. The center was preseason All-American and all that kind of stuff. So we start the game, And the first five shots he took, I blocked. Okay?
Mm.
They called timeout because they had never seen anything like that.
Right. It wasn't done in those days. You kind of brought it on. Mm-hmm.
So they called timeout. We go in the huddle. The first thing my coach says to me, you can't play defense like that.
Okay. 10 points.
I says, what do you mean? No good defensive player ever leaves his feet.
Oh, boy.
And so you're jumping. You can't do that. That's not the way to play defense. And then he showed me a quick little lesson on the sideline on how to play defense. So we go back out, and this guy gets three straight layups, playing the way he was telling me to play.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, no.
I've got to do what I've got to do.
And so we fought basically for 3 years with him telling me I was a bad defensive player.
And we still don't know his name.
Oh, no.
You know,
the reason I talk about those things was that the difference between Red's approach and this approach, instead of I never heard in the years we worked together, I never heard Red say to a player, I don't know how you played before you got here, but if you're going to play here, you got to do this, this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
What he would do is look at a player, evaluate him, evaluate what he does, and find a place for him in the system without changing him. Because if you change him, he has to take a step back, and that step back will take him out of his comfort zone in most cases.
So he wanted to do what it took to win. Bill Russell, let me ask you, in that same context, about race. It was the 1950s. You know, the lines were being broken and crossed here. Chuck Cooper, you remind us in the book, had already come in. First black player ever drafted into the NBA, drafted by the Boston Celtics in Boston, a city that was by no means any racial utopia. But they had brought Chuck in. You came in. When you say that Red Auerbach never had to show who's boss, are you talking at all about race there? Did race and pride come into that equation? Did that fact make it easier for you as a black basketball player to flourish?
Well, you can't live in America, especially those times, without acknowledging that all this stuff's going on.
Sure.
But I will say, factually, the matter of race was never a component of our relationship. It was strictly two men working together. That's why I called us co-workers. He never told me how to play, and I distinctly never told him how to coach. The reason I say that is when Casey Jones came out of the Army and he made the team, there was a lot of speculation in Boston that I had told Red to keep Casey on the team because I wanted him on the team. I can tell you today, I never once mentioned Casey to Red. Because to me, that would have been insulting to three people. Saying that Casey's not good enough to play. Telling Red how to coach. And throwing my weight around.
Yeah.
And none of those things were true. I never suggested to Red who to keep on the team or who not to keep on the team. I never even considered that. I considered him on our team, it was a unit.
Mm.
And as part of that unit, he coached. That was his duties in that unit. My duty was to play. Now, Red and I had the same agenda. Red coached in the NBA 20 years. He was coach of the year one time. And that was his last year.
Mm.
And the only reason voted him coach of the year then, they realized he'd been there 20 years and never been coach of the year. Now, I don't know if I left it in the book or not. I write books, I don't read them. the best job he did, I think, was 1964. Kuzi retired, and Kuzi is the starter of our offense. our point guard, and mastered running a fast break. Cousy retires, and we have Casey Jones, a great, great player, completely opposite of Cous. Now, to take that team and to go on winning seamlessly with a change at a key position, he did such a remarkable job in that is that the other teams never even noticed the difference.
Even through that transformation. Bill Russell, Dan Shaughnessy, Jack, we have so many listeners who want to get in here. I've got to let them in or they're going to break the door down, Bill. Let me get a couple of calls on. One from Manchester, New Hampshire. Joel, you're on the air with Bill Russell.
Mr. Russell, it is an honor to talk to you. My brother in Virginia is probably freaking out if he can hear me right now because he has been a Celtics fan for probably more time, longer than anybody can remember. I just have one quick question. I moved to Boston in 2002. To go to grad school, and coming from Virginia was completely and utterly shocked. You know, I had a Klan march in my town when I was in third grade, and and I thought I was coming to this bastion of liberalism. And you know, I had a security guard telling me what neighborhoods to stay out of and continue to be in, you know, be safe in. And
in 2002, yeah.
In 2002, and then I heard Byron Scott say, when he was coaching the New Jersey Nets, he said, Boston is still, hard to embrace the black athlete. And I wonder what you thought about just, race relations, in sports in Boston, where I think that lots of people still have those issues. What you thought about those and how they work right now? And again, like I said, my brother, if he's listening, he's probably mad at me because he would much rather be me than right now. But, it's a great honor to talk to you.
Joel, thanks for your call. Bill Russell, I don't know. The Celtics pretty beloved in Boston right now, but what about the way race has evolved there?
Well, I'll start out by telling you this story. John Havlicek and I were sitting at the airport. We used to, before the Jets, we spent a lot of hours at the airport. If it got foggy or cloudy, the planes wouldn't take off. So we're standing around the airport one day, and this guy walks up to me and says, "You a basketball player?" I said, "No." He walks away, and it happened about 3 or 4 times. Guys walk up, and "You're a basketball player?" I said, "No." So Havlicek says to me, "How come you always say you're not a basketball player?" Yeah. I said, "John, that's what I do. That's not what I am. I'm a man. My profession is basketball. And that's the way I have to treat it to do my best at it, is to play like we should have this thing, we say, play like children without being childish. Mm. Now, away from the court, as part of my family tradition, we always stood up for what we thought was right. And so with portions of the Boston community, we did not have good relations. But it didn't bother me. Because I would never let anybody do anything to me. But I don't like bullies. And I don't like people that will take advantage of people who can't defend themselves. And so that was part of the way I conducted my off-court activities.
Dan, how about today to Joel's question, race today, and the Celtics in Boston, or Bill?
Well, with Walter Brown... And Red Auerbach.
Owner back then, yep.
They were good men. And you see, all of us have opinions about race. But if you let these preconceived notions guide your conduct instead of good sense, you're a bigot. And a bigot is not worth being bothered with, as far as I'm concerned.
The pass to Ellis, back to West. He bottled up, out to Baylor, driving the lane. He lays it up, is blocked by Russell.
Blocked by Russell, what a play by Bill Russell.
Locked by Russell is Johnny Most in the Boston Celtics in the era of Bill Russell. We're talking with all-time NBA basketball great Bill Russell this hour about his life in the game and his great friend and coach, Red Auerbach. His new book is Red and Me, My Coach, My Lifelong Friend. He joins us from Seattle, Washington today. Our own Jack Beattie is here, and Dan Shaughnessy is here, a great sports columnist for the Boston Globe, author most recently of Senior Year, A Father, A Son, and High School Basketball. From Nashville, Tennessee, Carl, you're on the air with Bill Russell.
Mr. Russell, it is an absolute privilege and honor to speak to you. Basketball was standing. You mean more to more people than you would ever believe, and basketball is the least of them. So thank you very much for all your all the things that you've contributed to make society a little better. Thank you for your courage. Thank you for basketball. Yeah, have a good day.
Carl, we got it. Standing O from Nashville and a heartfelt. We can hear it. That's just great. Let's get one more. In Plymouth, Massachusetts, Nancy, you're on the air with Bill Russell.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling with just sort of a long historical story from 1959.
Okay.
Which was, I got married in January of 1959. And because we didn't have much money, we just went home to our new little apartment. And I don't know where I had been, but I came into the living room one evening, and there was my husband.
And where was this, Nancy? Was this Boston or?
Indianapolis.
Indianapolis, Indiana. Okay.
Yes. And there was my husband standing on the sofa listening to the radio that was in the apartment above us so that he could hear the Celtics.
To their radio.
He was from Boston, and I was certainly a basketball fan, but not to that extent.
That's great. And this is your honeymoon, but he's standing on tiptoe on the sofa for Bill, maybe.
Exactly right.
That's a great story.
Priorities.
Yeah, we got it. We got it. It's a great story, Nancy. Thanks. And let's one more here. Tom in Boston. You're on the air, Tom.
Well, good afternoon. Good morning, I should say.
Hi.
You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s and in Boston, and I remember going to the Boston Garden and watching the Celtics play. And you know, as we get older, we get a little bit more cynical about, especially about sports, because the whole nature has changed, and I've become cynical. But there's only one person who I idolized and who still makes my heart flutter. Don't know how excited as a 56-year-old man I am to talk to Mr. Russell, because he was my idol growing up. And I just wanted to say thank you for everything that you brought to basketball to Boston. You were my hero, my idol back then when I was a 12-year-old kid learning to play basketball. I wanted to be just like you, so thank you for that. My question is that when he played back then, it was a game of grace and agility, and it's become more of a physical game, and the court seems to have shrunk. And I was just wondering his thoughts on that aspect, and also whether he thinks that the court should be expanded and the height of the basket raised in order to compensate for the ability of today's athletes.
Wow. Bill, what do you say, the game now and then?
Well, first of all, I got 30 stitches around my eyes in the 13 years trying to get rebounds. So the game was not, in fact, I was talking to Oscar Robertson, and they put in the flagrant foul rule, and we both laughed for an hour.
It wasn't all grace.
But I like the way they play today. The only thing I get a chuckle out of nowadays is that the shorts look like skirts.
Of course, yours look like mini skirts.
Yeah.
Tight ones, hot pants.
You know, those guys that you mentioned, like Kobe and LeBron and Howard and all those guys are really good. But not one of them is any better than Elgin Baylor or Oscar Robertson.
Can I ask a question?
Danny, first, you're going to take issue with that in the presence of Bill Russell?
I love where this is going, and you know, this is one of those things hip in Boston. All we want to talk about is Russell and Will Chamberlain. I mean, when Will came into the league, Bill was established as the champion, and was viewed as this indomitable force who could average 50 points in a game. And Bill always managed to beat him when it mattered in the seventh game. They both would have extraordinary numbers. What was that like? How did you do that?
Well, first of all, let me tell you that it's a team game. And our strategy, and we knew how to play basketball. Like, we played the Lakers one night, and we played Philadelphia the other night. We played two different styles of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But we were with equal facility, though. Now, playing against Wilt, I think we used to talk all the time. I told him one night, I said, you know, Wilt, I think I'm the only person on the planet that knows how really good you are. But I ain't going to tell anybody.
There was one time, Bill, that you kept him from going after Red. Red was giving him heck with the chew of that cigar from the sideline, just dogging him and dogging him, just shouting out there. And he Wilt Chamberlain was just about to go after Red Auerbach, and you got in the middle of that.
Well, they were getting closer and closer together, and they were both cussing. And so I said, Red. He says, I'm not afraid of him. I said, Red, don't leave me alone. I'm not afraid of him. I said, Red, you're standing too close.
He's a bigger man.
He could break your face where you're standing. So Red takes two steps back and went back at him again. And then finally the referee said, let's go play. So after the game, Red says to me, thanks for looking out for me. I said, Red, I just didn't want him to get arrested for manslaughter.
Jack Beatty, you remember that matchup?
And the reason I said that from my very first game, whenever we did something for each other, we always said, I wasn't doing that for you. That's just, don't give me no thanks. I don't want no thanks. And so we always made a joke out of it whenever we did anything to protect the other guy.
Wow, that's good. Jack, how about Bill then? The game now and then, Bill and Chamberlain then, Wilt.
Well, I remember those games vividly. And to get back to the point I made at the beginning, you had a feeling that it was Bill's character, the kind of person he was, his inner strength that got him through those struggles with Chamberlain, because Chamberlain must have weighed about 300 pounds. And he had to have been the strongest person, at least visibly. You looked at him, and he was just—you could just see how muscular he was, and he was notoriously strong. And yet, Bill would go down there in the paint with him, and much slimmer Bill, and fight him off, and battle for those rebounds. And as I say, it looked as if he did it on Bill, as if you did it on courage and grit.
Willpower, Bill. I'm looking at a picture of you and Wilt Chamberlain, Game 7, 1969 Finals. And, you know, he is all muscle, and you're coming down on him like an avenging angel there, 6-13.
Well, Wilt was, besides being a friend of mine, was very, very difficult for me because he's such a great player. But we talked about it once, maybe twice, and I always, my approach was, when I'm at my best, there'll be room for my teammates to do their best. So a great deal of my play was without the ball.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a great, great player, and he thought that he was the best player on the planet, and nobody's going to ever argue with him about that. And he thought that if he went out and worked as hard as he could, would show his ability, then they should win the games. Should just overpower other teams.
Mm.
But my approach was, it's a team game. Now, what could I do? What skills must I use to make my team the best it can be? And so our approach was different. And he said that the difference was, you know, I used to say that if he was in Boston, he would have won all those championships. Well, he told me once, he said that was absolutely not true because his teams had to feed him to be his best. And I fed my teams to be at my best.
Two ways. Two great players. Let's get a call from Burlington, Vermont. Ted, you're on the air with Bill Russell.
Oh, thanks so much. I can't add anything else as far as accolades to Mr. Russell. honored to speak to him. I have two quick questions. One is, where does he stand on the weigh in on the Kobe, LeBron, Carmelo debate? And outside of basketball, who is the greatest winner in his opinion, seeing as how we all probably would agree he's the greatest winner in all of sports? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ted. Bill, Kobe, LeBron, Carmelo, and what about outside basketball, the greatest winner?
Well, I'll just have to see how these guys, you see, I'm an old-fashioned guy, and all of us think or philosophize according to our viewpoint. And so the guy that his team wins, that'll be the best one for me,
mm-hmm,
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And outside of basketball, baseball is more difficult. And in football, they always go to the quarterbacks. And so you got Brady. He's already there. Joe Montana. Then Bradshaw at Pittsburgh. All those guys won multiple championships. So
Take it on right on outside of sports, if you would, Bill Russell. What about our basketball playing president? You've written about leadership. He's in a leadership position now. What do you make of President Obama?
I know him quite well, okay? Mm-hmm. And my first impression was he's a very nice young man. And we know he's intelligent and thoughtful. And it seems to me that one of the things I like is that his heart seems to be in the right place. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm one of those guys. I met Jimmy Carter, must have been 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's long after he was president, so I don't know how long ago it was. And I said to him, I have great admiration for you. Not because of your presidency, but because you raised your children to have a social conscience. And that was not necessary, but it's something that says, to me, says something good about you and your wife, in that for love of family and love of country, to make your kids as good a citizen as you possibly can, to me, is admirable. And it seems that the present president has some of the same qualities in that to try to make the country as good as it can for the whole country. That's everybody.
Let me get a call.
Not
from...
just... Go ahead.
No, on that front, I want to get a call from Swansea. Our time is short here, and so many people clamoring. Dave in Swansea, Massachusetts, you've got a story for Bill Russell.
Yeah, yes, I do, Mr. Russell. Thank you for taking my call. A couple of comments. One, that Bill Russell was without a doubt the best center ever, and he was just any player, any era of time. And I can remember Willis Reed playing on one leg, and Chamberlain couldn't stop him. And I can remember Bill Russell being on one leg and winning championships. But the reason I want to call is... my father sold insurance with Tommy Heinsohn in the early 60s, so my brother and I used to get to go to a couple of the practices. Of course, we never saw Bill Russell because he didn't have to go, but Cousy didn't have to go either. But the best story is a friend of mine, it was either 67 or 68, went to a Celtics game with his girlfriend. After the game, he went to his car. He could not get it started. He was sitting in the parking lot for 1 hour, and all of a sudden comes out of the gardens was, you know, Bill Russell and his wife. And Bill Russell came over to his window and asked him what was wrong. He said, I can't get my car started. So, well, Bill Russell went and got his car, and he tried to give him a jump start. He couldn't. So obviously he was a great center, but not a very good mechanic. But that's a nice story.
That is a great story. A jump in the parking lot.
Thank you very much for letting me speak to you.
It's great to have you, Dave. You know, I want to get one piece of sound in here, Bill, just because you came to talk about Red. And here's a great Red moment. This is 1960 NBA championship. St. Louis Hawks pushed the Celtics to the brink. Game 7 at the Boston Garden. The Celtics told Coach Red Auerbach, you all told him you would throw him in the shower after the victory, and you did indeed win. Here's the voice of Celtics, the Celtics caller, Johnny Most, describing what happened next.
Red Auerbach, who's half undressed, is going to have to appear on national television. What a costume that is. With a cigar, tie open, no coat on.
Tie open, no coat on, you one. That's archival sound. We got this hour from Havlicek Stole the Ball. It's a Fleetwood sound recording provided by the Sports Museum at TD Bank North Garden, and a lot of thanks to the Sport Museum for that, Sports Museum. But there you were with your buddy Red, him half undressed, and Johnny Mose is going on national television. I know you came to talk about Red. Last thoughts on Red Auerbach that you want to leave with our listeners, Bill?
Well, this book I dedicated to his two daughters. Because our families were friends. And as I stated in the book, 2 hours after Red died, his daughter called me and said, "We've lost Daddy." She didn't say Red died or coach or whatever. She said, "We've lost Daddy." Because that's the kind of relationship we had. We were friends. And he was a man that knew how to be a friend. He had ultimate respect for himself. Because if you have respect for yourself, you understand how to respect other folks. And he was a brilliant coach. The way he coached me was, you know, for example, when you play good, you get in a groove. And if you don't take a break, that groove morphs into a rut. And they both look the same. And so he'd see me morphing, and he'd say, "Get away from me. Get away from the game. Go someplace.
Don't get in the rut." Bill, we've got every ounce we can from you today. We're grateful for your time. The book is Red and Me. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill Russell. Dan Shaughnessy, Jack Beattie, many thanks to you as well. What an honor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.